We've been, become so accustomed, haven't we, to hearing, at least hearing, and we hardly even notice it anymore, do we, that term abortion rights or a woman's right to choose. There's something that sounds fishy about it to us, and yet it often seems difficult to put our finger on what is fishy about it. I mean, I would be willing to say, does a woman have a right to choose? Well, up to a point, of course. Up to a point, of course. But does that right then go on and extend to the fact that she could choose to kill her unborn child? Something in me says, well, obviously, no. But why? What kind of thought process leads to what appears to be a very difficult and insoluble response to something like a woman's right to choose? People will say, well, the baby has a right to life, and that trumps the woman's right to choose. But does the woman's right to choose have a solid foundation in good thinking, like thinking about what rights really are, where rights come from? If a woman has a right to choose, where does it come from? That's a very interesting question. And the answer to that question will be a large part of the conversation we're going to have here on Issues Etc. during the first hour of the program. Hadley Arkus, architect of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act and Defense of Marriage Act, will be joining us here in just a few moments for that first conversation. A little later in the first hour, Marianne Hackett joins us, president of Illinois Right to Life. We're going to talk about some pro-life legislation in Illinois that is planned for the springtime. And then, in the second hour of the program, open lines for your questions and your comments. A lot of things we did not get to yesterday during open lines, we will get to today during open lines. And then, in the third hour of the program, Dr. Daniel Hoffman of Lee University joins us. We'll review this best-selling book, Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas, by Elaine Pagels. We'll find out what it is she is advocating in that book. And then to round off the 3 hours of Issues Etc. today, Amy White, our good friend, corporate and political speechwriter, author of a column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled Iowa Reality Check. She'll join us from Oakville, where we'll get her take on the three frontrunners for this coming week's caucus in Iowa on the Democratic ticket. That's the lineup for Issues Etc. today. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, feel free to do so. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Hadley Arkus is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. He's professor of American Institutions at Amherst College. As I said before, architect of the Born Alive Infant Protection Act and Defense of Marriage Act, and author of several books, including his latest, which I will at the very outset here recommend in the highest, Natural Rights and the Right to Choose. Hadley, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Oh, thanks for having me, Todd. And I think I was on with you last the time that the president signed the Born Alive Infants Protection Act. And you were marvelous. The station was marvelous in covering that. And but it came that the book was in press before we knew that the act had definitely been passed. And so we're about to put out a paperback edition of the book, and we'll be able to mention the fact that the bill was indeed passed, and so I'm happy to be back with you.
It's very good to have you back. You write early in the book, Natural Rights and the Right to Choose, that Americans, all of us to one degree or another, even people who call themselves pro-life have bought into many of the presuppositions that go along this line, Americans have fallen into what you call an inadvertent treason. What do you mean by that?
Well, there are many places which people can be quite affable, and they drift into things without quite realizing that they're altering the very premises on which their freedoms are founded. I was just in a discussion today, for example, on the use of international courts, you know, to vindicate certain rights, in the case of Saddam Hussein and others. And here are people who, not sure they want Saddam Hussein, you know, dealt with by Iraq or by America. And they want what kind of an international court? And you say, it's some kind of court existing by itself. It's not part of a system of laws and we understand that by laws we mean the only people authorized to make laws over us are people who have been elected, who enjoy the consent of the governed. And so we think, well, this is, are people asking us for the sake of having courts directing their own prosecutions, and which detach us from a very critical notion on our part, that the only rightful government over human beings is that which draws its powers from the consent of the governed. Now, I mentioned in the book that case of Lincoln's used to mention Senator Pettit of Indiana, who used to say that the self-evident truth of the Declaration, that all men are created equal, was really a self-evident lie. Now, look, this was, we understand that one of the chief inferences from that proposition, all men are created equal, was that no human being was the ruler of other human beings by nature, in the way that God was by nature the ruler of men, and men were by nature the ruler of horses and dogs. And hence the understanding that if some men are in the position of governing over others, that situation can't arise from nature, it must arise from consent. Now, here was an officer in a republic who had utter contempt for the very premise on which our freedoms were based, the very premises that supported a government in which he had standing as a high officer, a senator. And it stands to reason that the person who could acquiesce in the enslavement of other men, of course, had contempt for the very basic premise. Now, what I'm suggesting in the book that is that people have been working, many people, members of the political class, the class that is most active politically, the people who are active in politics, hold office, actually hold places in the courts of the United States, have talked themselves out of the premises of natural rights as they've talked themselves into the right to choose, the right to decide just who is a human being, that this child conceived by human beings is not really a human being, and we could simply put that child in the class of beings who are not bearers of rights. So in a number of very subtle ways, people talk themselves out of the deepest premises behind our natural rights.
If I cannot vindicate the rights of my fellow, I would put this term, citizen, the unborn.
Exactly right.
If
yeah.
I cannot vindicate the rights of my fellow citizen, even in the womb, can I in any way hope to vindicate my own rights?
No, that's exactly the point, because what you're doing then is, there is saying, and boy, you've been reading this book closely, I can see. As ever. You read them more closely than I wrote them. What we're saying is that many educated people have talked themselves into the notion that I can take a human life as it suits my convenience, and then they recoil from that. They say, no, I don't want to say that. It's not really a human life. I can make my own judgment as to what a human life is as that suits my convenience. Well, if people can simply say now, what is a human life is what people in power can say it is. We can simply change the labels and say these aren't Jews, these are non-Aryans, these are not human beings, they're fetuses. By making a simple shift of that kind, we can put anybody outside the realm of beings with a claim to the protection of the law. Now, so when people sort of assert their right to choose, you say, you raise the question in the introduction, from what do you draw that right to choose? Well, from the fact that we're dealing with moral agents, people can reason over matters of right and wrong, and we recognize in them a certain kind of capacity to deliberate about the grounds of their well-being. And if we also have the sense, in the past, that those beings were made in the image of something higher. And if some say, why is it wrong to take a human life? Well, we think there's something portentous about it. I told a story in the book about that, if you forgive me on this, just take more time with this one, that shooting that took place outside of a clinic in Boston, and an abortion clinic. And then there was a vigil a few nights later. There was a young woman there with her newborn daughter, and she said, I'm here to protect the reproductive rights of my child, my newborn infant. And we said, that's interesting. If that infant... daughter had these reproductive rights, when did she acquire them? If they flow to her simply by virtue of being a female, then she had those rights while she was in the womb. She was a bearer of those rights. And if she had those rights, then her mother couldn't have been warranted in sweeping away all those rights through the simple expedient of sweeping away in a stroke the bearer of the rights. So that must not be the story. It must be that we all acquire our rights, not because there's anything intrinsic in that child that deserves to be respected. We acquire those rights when the mother here, in this case, in a grand kind of Nietzschean gesture, says, I now confer upon you the right to live. It's a right conferred by the powerful. And I confer that right upon you because there's nothing about you that I regard as inconsistent with my interests. Well, Todd, as I argue, if that is now the story about the way any of us gets our rights, then our rights don't begin with anything of intrinsic dignity in the human being that deserves to be respected. An intrinsic dignity that becomes, in turn, the source of rights of an intrinsic dignity that command our respect. Instead, we get this notion that rights are something conferred by the powerful, not because any of us is made in the image of something higher. Rights are conferred by the powerful, and they can be sustained or abridged or qualified at any time, as long as that suits the interests of the people who confer them. And if that's the case, you say, well, then what does a right to abortion mean then? It's some kind of a right that those in power confer. They can remove it. They can restrict it as it suits their convenience. It's a right that that can't be vindicated any longer. And to pick up on your line here, which you nicely drew from my book, if we come to the position of saying that none of us has any intrinsic dignity, the source of any rights of an intrinsic dignity, we're no longer in a position to explain why any of us deserves the defense of his rights. We're no longer in a position to give a moral account or moral defense of those rights. So the people who talk themselves into this understanding can no longer give a coherent account even of that right to abortion. It just ceases to be the kind of firm right that its exponents all presume it is. But they've also put themselves in a position in which they can't give a moral account of any other right we have, and they've become for us just the infirmest allies, people who could not be depended on to explain why any of us have rights. Any one of us has rights that can be defended and which the majority would be obliged to respect.
So to just walk a bit back over the ground you just covered, in short, if a woman's right to choose is hers by birth, that is because she is a woman, which seems to be kind of the assertion here that is often left unchallenged, then the woman in the womb has reproductive rights, therefore all the other rights.
That's right. You can't sweep her away.
And yet you say, okay, no, that can't work and still abort my baby. Maybe I give my child the right to live. Then rights become something bestowed by the powerful upon the weak. There's no reason in the world why the government or any other powerful agency couldn't abridge my rights on a whim for
sure.
Any reason whatsoever.
Exactly. Now we say it's simply conferred by the powerful as it suits our convenience. Well, okay, now the majority is the powerful. So we can simply, restrict those rights. To pick up your line, that it's a right that flows to human beings by nature. It's a species of natural right that we don't depend on anybody to vote on whether we are human beings. And now you're telling us, we don't know what a human being is by nature. We'll decide who is a human being.
You talk about rights that are truly rightful.
Yes.
And I suspect that's another way of talking about what the founders would have recognized as natural law. They'd have encoded
right,
in the
exactly
Declaration
right
of Independence.
Exactly right.
Tell us about that.
Well, both a sense of moral truths. That, you can create a kind of local rights. You can use the right to use the squash courts, or the right to use the tennis courts. This is a right that grows out of a local association. The example that was quite common among the founders, 18th and 19th century, to talk about rights that grow out of governments, and rights that grow and rise from nature. So if I take the visitor from abroad who comes, say, from London and lands in New York, we don't think we'd have to see his passport to see his citizenship in order to protect him from a lawless assault on the street. You think that any human being would have a rightful claim to be protected from a lawless, unjustified assault. Doesn't matter who it is. But you don't think that he could take himself over to the City College of New York and get a subsidized rate of tuition, the things that are available to the citizens of New York. Well, you know, we're living in a time in which people want to tell us now there are no moral truths of that kind. See, we used to draw these things, you know, from the very nature of human beings. You'd say, if you understand the nature of human beings, beings who can give and understand reasons, then one of the implications of that is that we cannot rule, we should not rule beings who can give and understand reasons the way that we rule beings like horses and cows that just cannot, we don't seek the informed consent of our household pets before we authorize surgery on them. So we think, well, this is a right that must flow distinctly to human beings. It's a truth, it's a right that is grounded in the very nature of human beings. It will be the same wherever in the world human nature is the same and human beings are distinguishable from animals. But now the inclinations say that there are no truths of that kind. We simply create rights, conventional rights. Your right to use the squash court is the same as your right not to be assaulted without justification on the street. These are rights we give to each other. The majority votes them into place, or judges proclaim them. But they're all conventional. There are no real moral truths lying behind them. It's just the way that most of us prefer to live. And there's nothing more to it than that. But with that, you certainly lose entirely the sense that these rights are anything more than merely conventional. In other words, if I understand that there are truly rights and wrongs, then as Lincoln used to say, we cannot claim a right to do a wrong. That is, by wrong, we used to understand that which no one ought to do, that which no one should be free to do, that anyone could be rightfully restrained from doing. So Lincoln, you wouldn't say, it's wrong to torture an infant, but let people decide how to torture or not as it suits their inclinations. If we say it's wrong, we mean that no one ought to do it. Well, when we speak about rights and wrongs in that way, then when we say it's wrong to torture your infant, wrong to kill an innocent child, we're saying that's wrong, and you can't have any plausible right to do it. Or the right of the child not to be handled in that way is a right that is truly rightful. It's not merely conventional, not because we've decided this week that we're going to protect children and next week we're going to play squash.
Now, I'm curious, where did this shift from natural rights occur? Was it primarily in the halls of the judiciary?
No, it's ancient. You know, we go back to Plato, and you know, there's nothing recent about self-interest, people being animated by their own self-interest and seeking their own satisfaction. So you think of Nathan's retort to David for putting Uriah out of the way, and also take a look at Plato and Thrasymachus asserting that justice is the rule of the strong. But what came about sort of in the middle of the 19th century with Darwin, say, you know, life is simply the adaptation and the struggle for survival. But what came along also was a kind of moral skepticism had been around for a long time. You know, serious things done in the 18th century with Bishop Berkeley and David Hume. But skepticism, the insistence that there were no truths in morality. Morality is merely conventional, simply a matter of opinion, that there were no anchoring truths in morality comparable to the anchoring truths in mathematics or physics. So these are people who thought that Darwin had eliminated revelation. We can't know moral on the things through revelation. And we cannot know them through reason. And so this was really taking hold in the academy and then making its way into the schools of law as soon as you had schools of law. I mean, schools of law come along with a new science of law at the end of the 18th century. And the new science of law is a science of skepticism, that what is right or wrong, what is lawful or not, is that which is simply propounded or proclaimed by people in authority. What is law? It's the commands put forth by people who have the power to make law. Well, that became quite a dominant theme in shaping law schools. It made its way from the academy into the law schools. And, you know, it's interesting that after the Civil War, and after the famous argument, debate between Lincoln and Stephen Douglas in 1858, where Lincoln represented the side of natural law or natural rights, and Douglas represented that side of cultural relativism or legal positivism, that is, what is right or wrong is that which is merely posited, set down, enacted, that all notions of right and wrong are simply relative to the ideas that prevail, opinions that prevail in any place. Well, here you can't account for the Civil War and for Lincoln's victory in that contest without understanding the hold that the idea of natural rights and natural law had on the American people. But the cruel irony is that not long after the Civil War, the shift took place. And so by the end of the 19th century, it was taking hold, really, of the intellectual elite in some of the better schools. And by the turn of the century, the transition had been largely completed, that natural law was some kind of, as Justice Holmes would say, some kind of brooding omnipresence in the sky, or, as Jeremy Bentham said, nonsense on stilts. It's just airy, abstract ideas with no real force and no cognitive significance, nothing that one could truly understand. And the way one understood propositions about right and wrong, these are just airy ideas with no real intellectual force. And that's what we encountered this again coming out of the Second World War, and moral relativism seemed to be the rage in the academy, certainly when I started teaching in the mid-60s at Amherst. And we never would have anticipated, that we probably should have, that 30 years later, it has not ameliorated anyway. If anything, it's just become worse.
We're talking with Hadley Arkus, Professor of American Institutions at Amherst College. He's architect of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act and the Defense of Marriage Act. He's author of several books, including his latest, Natural Rights and the Right to Choose. When we come back, several other things before we wrap up our conversation with Hadley. First of all, have you been quelled into silence, folks, by someone who says, look, this is a right which, well, in addition to trumping all other human rights, this woman's right to choose also leaves you out of any position to object to the woman's choice. Well, if she chooses to allow her child to live, you can object or approve, but it really makes a little difference. But if she chooses not to allow her child to live, to abort her child, you certainly are in no position to object. We'll deal with that when we come back, and with a recent quote from one of the Democratic contenders for president, Wesley Clark, who seems to have embodied all of what is wrong with our abandonment of natural rights in a single phrase when he said very recently, life begins with the mother's decision. If you'd like to join us, our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more with Hadley Arkus.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you noticed in many churches today, the God you find is convenient and non-confrontational, a sugar-sweet pushover of a God? What's happening when God seems to be against you, when God seems to be your problem, when God seems to be your enemy? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for January is called When God Becomes My Enemy. Through this in-depth study of the Old Testament complaint psalms, you'll discover the truth about God in the darkest of times. To order When God Becomes My Enemy, call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on our Issues Etc. book of the month for January, When God Becomes My Enemy. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc., 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on people in India who are making tough decisions. The Ministry India Evangelical Mission operates a Bible college that's filled to capacity with students. One of the students, named Jason, was a school teacher who believed God was leading him to the Bible college. He wanted to enter full-time ministry, but his parents became so angry that they decided to disown him. Jason remains determined to minister in India, where hundreds of thousands of villages have no gospel witness. Another Bible college student is a man named Vainu, who graduated from India Evangelical Mission's Children's Home in 1988. Pray that Bible college students with India Evangelical Mission will enjoy God's blessings. Learn more about India with a free booklet called To India with Love. Call 1-800-268-0461. That's 800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Last week I was in Fargo, North Dakota, leading a workshop for pastors. By coincidence, Governor Howard Dean made a campaign appearance in the same hotel. A standing room only crowd. I settle in the back, almost in a corner. Behind me, a young grade school girl is sitting on the floor in that corner doing her homework. Dale, I keep telling myself, don't back up and put your size 11s on that poor girl. After the governor's stump speech, he did some Q&As. When one partisan asked about late-term abortions, Dean replied that the whole 9 months are no one's business but the mothers and the doctors. Thunderous approval. When you start allowing theology to rule medicine, he expounded, you've got a problem. A slippery half-truth, I think. Yes, if, for example, you ignore God's gifts through medicine and rely on a scripturally uninformed faith, but it's false if you divorce medical ethics from the moral values of biblical theology. I was out of step with that abortion rights crowd. I kept reminding myself not to back up and hurt that child behind me. Don't hurt the child behind you, but we can still hurt, kill the child within the womb? Who's out of step?
As the chill of winter is in the air, a brisk breeze from the north is carrying the American bald eagles into the Alton region once again. Have you ever wanted to see a live eagle up close and personal? Well, here's your chance. Plan a scenic drive up the meeting of the Great Rivers National Scenic Byway this winter to gaze at these majestic birds of prey from afar. Then plan a stop at the Alton Visitors Center to catch a glimpse of a live eagle up close and personal at the Alton Visitors Center's Eagle Meet and Greet. It's every Saturday in January from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m.
After a few more minutes here with Hadley Arkus, we're going to be talking with Mary Ann Hackett, president of Illinois Right to Life, about what awaits the legislature in both Missouri and Illinois, but in particular in Illinois, in the new legislative session here in the spring. It sounds like there's more on the docket than one might have imagined. We'll be talking with her about that to round off this hour of Issues, Etc. Hadley Arkus is our guest, professor of American Institutions at Amherst College. He's architect of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act and Defense of Marriage Act, and he's author of several books, including his latest, Natural Rights and the Right to Choose. Hadley, from what you were saying before the break, it strikes me that a simple way of describing what's happened is that the abandonment of natural rights has really been the abandonment of my fellow man. I don't see something in my fellow man worth defending.
That's right. That's quite true. I recall the conversation with one of my former students who said he really had never been as enamored of natural rights as I've been. And I said, well, why is that? And then we were talking, and I said, well, and then the conversation centered on some homeless man in the gutter. And I said, somebody's broken his own life. And I said, well, why do we treat him as though he has some kind of dignity? And he said, well, it's because of the way we've come to view him and, you know, our culture. And I said, well, wait a minute, you've stopped talking about him. You talk about our lens, how we view him and our culture, but is there anything about him that has an intrinsic dignity? And people walk around, you know, trip into saying things like, well, there's a certain sanctity about him. You say sanctity, you mean of the sacred? And you get this from people who've long abandoned any sense of religiosity. Certainly they've drifted away from their Christian or Jewish roots. And you realize that so much of our language of discussion, so much of our moral discourse, our moral reflexes here, the way we describe things, really depends on an understanding that's been rooted in, or finds its deep sources in, the reservoir of our religious understanding. And the terms continue. The people continue to talk in that way, even though the religious understanding that once nourished that way of talking seems to have evaporated from them.
Making the connection, again, as you did earlier, between this issue and the time of slavery, in particular that of Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
Lincoln was anxious to point out that if one man, at least under the doctrine of slavery that he was combating with Stephen Douglas, if one man sought to enslave another, a third party really had no right to object. It was simply none of their business. Does the same thing prevail today with the right to choose?
Yeah, that's right. Lincoln said Douglas's policy could be reduced to this, that one person may enslave a second, and a third may not object. And now the line is, as Russ Hittinger has pointed out, my friend Russ Hittinger at the Tulsa University, one person may kill a second, and a third may not object. That it's a matter of privacy now.
This tends to say...
That's a remarkable thing that you were quoting from Wesley Clark. I mean... a decision on, you know, he's...
From Wesley Clark, this life begins with the mother's decision, he said recently.
Well, but first of all, the mother doesn't have a decision to make until she's aware of a pregnancy, right? So life has already begun. If it hadn't begun, she wouldn't be faced with a decision. And if she is pregnant, then, you know, even before modern embryology, as we've known it, people of the founding generation certainly understood that if she's pregnant, she wasn't pregnant with a squirrel or a pigeon. That even Wesley Clark must understand that if she's pregnant, there can't be any question of the species of the offspring that she's bearing. And does he think would he or Howard Dean think that when you say that the law can't say anything for 9 months, do they happen to think that the child is undergoing a change of species in that period? Or the question of what the species of their child is happens to be a religious question? This is just bizarre. And I would say people in the middle of the 19th century, before the advent of all this college education, and even before the advent of modern embryology, people in the middle of the 19th century would have been embarrassed to be speaking in this way. This is a kind of imbecilic way of talking about anything. But this may be, again, one of the fruits of a modern education that can no longer distinguish these things.
One person that I bounced that Wesley Clark quote off of said, look, General Clark is simply, perhaps in kind of a ham-fisted political way, saying out loud what others have couched in euphemism for so many years.
Well, to pick up on what you're saying, why isn't it the mother's choice about the removing the child who's already in the house, the one-year-old or the two-year-old who's becoming a strain? Why don't we say that's the woman's choice? Well, not because the child is human at one period and not human at another. You know, you don't know how people talk themselves into it, but it's evident that there is not very strenuous reasoning that stands behind this.
Wesley, before we end, you had mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that a second edition of the book is in the works to deal with the unfolding saga of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act. What will be included there?
I can't make it. It's not really a second edition, but we are at least going to put the notation. Note the fact that the bill was to our surprise after September 11th that the bill, the concern with protecting children who survive abortions, that concern was going to be pushed to the periphery and didn't have much of a chance of making it through the Congress, but it did. It was brought out. It was not brought out in the form that we liked, and it was not brought out with all the findings and the premises made explicit in order to make people clear on what we were teaching through the bill. In other words, part of the teaching was that even the child marked for an abortion had a claim to the protection of the law that could not pivot on the question of whether anyone wanted her. That's an important point to make. And it's curious that even Rick Santorum, who sponsored the bill in the Senate, when he came to talk about the bill after that, just never really got it in those terms and never gave quite a good account of it. But what we're doing is just taking note of the fact that the bill was, to our astonishment, brought forth both in the House and Senate and signed by the President, who curiously had never endorsed the bill, never spoke in its behalf. And one of my disappointments with Mr. Bush is that his instincts seem to be in the right place. His administration is filled with people I would have there, people who are pro-lifers at every level of the administration. But he himself seems to be very reticent and very diffident about making the argument in public, and I fear that can be quite corrosive, that he's giving the public to understand that somehow it's impolitic or not quite respectable to state the pro-life argument in public. And that's where I think, you know, our president could be given a prod, because he has with him some marvelously talented speechwriters. If he wished to make those arguments, he has the means available to make them. And the curious question is to why he is so reluctant to speak. One of my lingering disappointments with an otherwise terrific administration. Yeah.
Hadley, thank you very much for the book, and thanks for being our guest again on Issues, Etc.
Todd, thank you so much. You've been very dear about your willingness to have me on, but you've rendered an even deeper compliment with the care with which you always read everything I've written. So it's a deep pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much.
It's all worth well worth the reading, for sure. Hadley Arkus is professor of American Institutions at Amherst College, architect of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act and Defense of Marriage Act, and author of several books, including his latest. And again, I will recommend it for your reading, folks. This is the kind of thing you need to read, especially if you find yourselves one of those people who is often set back on your heels when someone says, "How can you object to my right?" This book is for you. It's called Natural Rights and the Right to Choose. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to be spending some time talking about the legislative agenda when it comes to the life issue in the state of Illinois. Our guest, Mary Ann Hackett, president of Illinois Right to Life, joins us for the remainder of this first hour of Issues, Etc. Mary Ann, welcome back.
Hi, how are you?
Doing very well. Give us a brief recap, if you would, of 2003 when it comes to legislative action or pro-life action in the state of Illinois.
Well, Governor Blagojevich signed in a pro-life law that required that insurance coverage for our state employees would not cover abortion except to save the life of the mother. And another one was that it expands the state's recognition of the unborn by requiring a stillbirth certificate for infants stillborn after just 20 weeks gestation, and it strengthened the conscience protection that people will not be required to provide insurance for procedures that violate or abridge a person's or an entity's conscience, which protects hospitals that do not do abortions and do not wish to do abortions from covering that type of thing. But I think we're looking forward to working on legislation for this year now, although we're still threatened by the Equal Rights Amendment. We have to work to defeat that, because it will certainly establish a right to abortion on the basis of equality. Another thing that we have to work to defeat is the Stem Cell Research Act, which, although it's called the Stem Cell Research Act, it provides for cloning. It's a pro-cloning bill, and it creates it as public policy. So that's a very dangerous bill also. But the other one is they're still trying to pass the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, which will serve to keep away pro-lifers from praying or talking to the women going in. So those are all bills that we have to be sure do not get passed into law in this state. We had a legislative meeting this week and talked about some interesting bills that we're agreed to work on. One is to a definition of a viable infant that any doctor who intends to perform an abortion after 20 weeks must determine the viability of the child, and if the child may be born alive, must provide for another physician in attendance to care for the child. That's a very important bill. One other thing is they hope to adopt the federal description of the Born Alive Infant Protection Act, the actual wording of the federal law, which would make us conform to what was passed in Washington, and which is also a good step.
Now, I'm curious about a few things. Before we go on to the particulars, you had mentioned there in a little more detail.
Okay.
In terms of pro-choice legislation passed in Illinois last year, how would you run down 2003 in those terms?
Well, I really can't give you definitive answers about that because I don't think what the legislation, I don't know of any legislation that was passed that extends the right to abortion or removes the protection from the unborn last year.
So in other words, this is my sense of it, Marianne, that with 2003, we not only had kind of a banner year with the first major legislation at the federal level that would have abridged the right to abortion in the ban on partial birth abortion.
Right, right.
But it sounds as though it's been a pretty good year for pro-life legislation. 2003 was in several states, including Missouri and Illinois.
Yes, right. Those that I mentioned that were actually signed into law by the governor. And, you know, the predictions were that because it was almost a clean sweep of Democrats at the last election, and also the fact that the Democratic representatives and senators tend to take a pro-abortion position, there was very little hope of getting anything through. The very fact that some pro-life legislation passed, I think, shows that there are pro-lifers in both parties in our legislature.
Very briefly, what spurred Governor Blagojevich to sign pro-life legislation?
Well, apparently it was legislation that had a great deal of backing for it. For instance, I think most people back a conscience clause and prohibits people from being forced to do things against their religious beliefs. That would be something that might be universally acceptable among all the people that, you know, in the legislature. And he probably, I would guess, it passed by a large vote. The report that I had was from Americans United for Life that reported those things that the governor signed. Those they considered highlights of last year.
So he may well have just simply wanted to avoid a veto override or something along those lines.
Yes, because essentially that doesn't exactly restrict the right to abortion. If it were something that restricted the right to abortion, for instance, we don't seem to be able to get through parental consent and informed consent for the women or women's right to know. Although that is another bill that we hope to work on this year. The reasonable thing is that more and more women are coming out now saying that they regret their abortion. There's a Silent No More campaign around the country, and women last year, just in a week's time, over 800 women came forward to say they regret their abortion. And the follow-up of that is, if they had known many of the things that they know now, if they had been truly informed of the decision when they made their decision, they would not have made that decision. And I think we have to approach it from that point of view, that if you were receiving or being recommended to have any other type of surgery, you would get full knowledge of all the possible after effects, complications, what could happen. But that the only type of surgery that you don't get that is abortion.
Now, on the issue of the Equal Rights Amendments, certainly a blast from the past.
Yes.
Tell us about the history of that attempted amendment in the state of Illinois when it was being entertained actively as a constitutional amendment.
Well, it was defeated, and there was a real activity by Eagle Forum. Phyllis Schlafly led the charge, actually, had thousands of women descend on the Capitol, and they were successful in defeating that bill. And as a matter of fact, I think former Governor Ryan was helpful in that respect, although he later said he didn't know if he would have done that again. But the point of the matter, the fight on that issue, and I think what mobilized the women and families in Illinois was the fact that it was clear that if the Equal Rights Amendment would pass, it would establish the right to abortion on the basis of equal treatment, that women were being denied equality under the law. In fact, the states that have passed Equal Rights Amendment have actually used the Equal Rights Amendment in their states to prevent any restrictions on abortion.
So it would not be in any way, it would be a major framework for impeding pro-life legislation.
Absolutely, because that would be brought up whenever legislation would be introduced. It would be say, well, under the Equal Rights Amendment, we can't restrict abortion in this state because it's guaranteed. It's a guaranteed right for women. And another thing that's a little bit off the subject and on another subject, but there's a total consensus that it would also allow for homosexual marriage.
How is that?
It would allow for homosexual marriage because that's another thing that they would consider they didn't have equal rights for people who are allowed to get married, and it would open the door for homosexual marriage.
Now, you had mentioned the Born Alive Infants Protection
Act
that passed federally. We were just talking with Hadley Arkus, the architect of that entire bill, just a few minutes ago. I take it there is an Illinois state version that is in the docket for the new legislative session?
Yes. What they want to do, we've talked about other wording, but what we want to do is conform exactly to the wording of the federal law. Because if we use any slightly different words or slightly different terms, then we'll be told that it's unconstitutional because it doesn't conform to the state, to the national law. And in fact, when the law passed nationally, it passed by a vote of 98-2, I think, and the leading pro-abortion senators actually voted for it, like Kennedy and Boxer and those people. So we want this law to conform exactly in the wording, because then we can use that even the pro-abortion senators in Washington, in our national Congress, voted to support this wording. So what's the contention, in other words? It's the same wording exactly. And they felt that was an important bill to get through. And I would hope, although it's hard to be too optimistic, I would hope that since it is in exact conformance with the national law, that there wouldn't be a lot of opposition to it.
You mentioned the woman's right to know. The happiest day in the Missouri legislature in 2003, as far as I was concerned, was the passage of the woman's right to know, even though it's still enjoined by the courts.
Right.
Are there plans in Illinois for such a bill to appear?
Yes, but that was another thing we agreed to work for, is the woman's right to know bill. As I say, the informed consent is essential for a woman, particularly so she is not faced with the terrible regrets that she has, and that she can actually make a choice based on the real consequences of what will happen to her. And of course, the objection to it by the pro-abort element of our society is that we're trying to stop abortions. But the fact of the matter is it probably will reduce some abortions, because if women know the full range of consequences, that many of them will choose not to have abortion. But for people who claim to be advocates of women, why would they want women not to know whether they choose of an abortion? That we've always been told that women are adults and they can make their own decisions. But why would they not want women to have that information then?
Marianne, will any kind of parental consent or notification bill, is it just a pipe dream in Illinois? That is one of the biggest thorns in the side of the state, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it is a thorn that children, literally, minors, can come into our state from other surrounding states that have parental consent or notification laws and get abortions in our state. And it's a defiance of the rights of parents to guide their children. And I think we do have support, even among people who think abortion should be legal. They don't think people should be allowed to operate on their daughter without their knowing on it. In fact, I understand that Missouri has passed legislation making it a crime for someone to go to Illinois to have an abortion to avoid their laws. And that's a great step forward. If Indiana and the other surrounding states did that also, people would probably be reluctant to get here. But we should have our own parental consent law. Young people, minors, should have some other advocate for their health than the abortionist who stands to make money from the procedure. It leaves the minor child, minor girl, without any protection against the abortionist. There's no one else that she can consult with. There's no one else, in fact, who has her best interest at heart, which is her husband, her parents. There's no one to protect her from the abortionist who has his own interest at heart.
Yesterday, Americans United for Life, a pro-life group, cited both Illinois and Missouri and gave them their top rating. Why is that?
Well, because we were successful in getting some legislation passed, although I must say the legislation that passed is not the what we want. The essential legislation is we want protection for the woman and protection for the child.
Should someone read that high rating from Americans United for Life as though Illinois in particular were a pro-life state?
No, absolutely not. Because the you look at other states do have parental notification laws. Other states do have women's right to know laws. Other states have some restrictions on late-term abortion. I think this would be a good will be a good step in determining the viability of a child. Certainly, that late-term abortions will be somewhat restricted in that aspect, because the doctor will be, if he intends to do an abortion late on the child, he has to determine viability and then have another physician to save the life of the child that's born. So that's a positive pro-life bill. But Illinois, I don't think in the current climate in the legislature could possibly be considered a pro-life state.
Marianne Hackett, for that reason alone, keep up the good work.
We'll be working on it.
Thank you very much for being our
Thank
guest.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Marianne Hackett, president of Illinois Right to Life, a little review of pro-life legislation in Illinois and a preview of what may lie ahead in the spring legislative session. If you'd like to go to the website for Illinois Right to Life, it's IllinoisRightToLife, all one word, .org, IllinoisRightToLife.org, or you can call them at area code 312-422-9300. That's 312-422-9300. When we come back from this break, Dr. Daniel Hoffman joins us. You've seen this at Barnes & Noble, haven't you? No, I'm sorry. That's in the fifth hour. I mean, the third hour, isn't it? When we come back from this break, we got open lines. I need to change the order of my stuff sitting in front of me here. Reach over and grab my folder. Now, when we come back, this is something we didn't get to yesterday. The Reverend Al Sharpton. You know all the God talk that's been going on. Howard Dean, of course, has made a few gaffes in talking about his faith and why he did this and why he did that. And, of course, many people see through it as a transparent attempt to garner some favor in the South, which is viewed as more religious than other parts of the nation. Reverend Al Sharpton has a few things to say about Howard Dean's God Talk when we come back. Very sensible stuff. You'll hear it, and we'll get your reaction during Open Lines when we return.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.